New research conducted by Safe Food finds that families on lower incomes need to spend up to one third of their weekly income in order to afford a healthy food basket. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Joanna Da Silva. She's Chief Specialist in Nutrition at Safe Food. Joanna, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, Kira. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. That, though, is a staggering proportion of your weekly income on food. And there's a lot to unpack there. The cost of food being one.
The cost of food being one, and then the percentage of the take-home income that cost represents for some of the families. And you were right, spot on there. It's up to one-third of the take-home income for families that are depending on state benefits.
Now, when we say a healthy basket of food, that might mean one thing to one person and a completely different thing to another person. How does Safe Food view that?
So actually, Kira, I must say this, I know you're talking to Robert later. Safe Food works with the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice, and Robert did a lot of the work for this report. The methodology that it's used to establish the cost of a food basket is through a consensus with focus groups that represent those households that you see on the report that we launched today. And we pick those households because they would be at a higher risk of food poverty. So through focus groups, we agree what's acceptable and what is. Of course, there is a health element to that. The food basket meets nutritional requirements, but very, very importantly, social ones too. Mm. So you will see that the budget includes an allowance for special occasions, so parents can celebrate a child's birthday, for example. There is an allowance for a takeaway, and there is an allowance for someone to be able to offer a biscuit to the neighbor that calls in for a chat. And those are very important to be able to live in society is very important to all of us, and we need to feel that inclusion to the norm.
And it's also, I suppose, important for the veracity of the research as well, that it takes into account, which clearly it does, the way we live our lives.
Yes, absolutely. But the research is based on needs and not wants. So it's very important that we emphasize that those elements that we included, it's something that we all need. It's not something that we want.
Even within the research, there are family groups and types which are more adversely affected by the cost upon them of trying to afford a basic and healthy diet. In particular, for example, for a family of four living on benefits, two adults and two children, one in primary and one in secondary school, €169 per week. That's 35%
yes.
of their household income. That's
yes.
eye-watering.
Yeah, I know. And the food cost rises as the children grow. So the food the cost is significantly higher for someone with an adolescent. The cost of an adolescent was almost double of the cost of the food for a child for a preschool. So it's not a problem that is going to get easier as our children grow up, you know, Kira. And that's very important to highlight too.
And just for context for everybody, that particular household was spending 35% of their household income on food per week. So the CSO tells us that the average spend per household on food was 14.7% of their
yes.
income. There's a huge gap there.
It's disproportionate. And that's just food. At the same time, these families are trying to cope with other expenses. You know, it's the electricity, it's the gas, it's the uniform, it's the rent. And people have to make very, very difficult decisions. Am I going to use the electricity today to warm up my house or to get the oven going and to cook? No one should be expected to face that decision.
And those decisions are going to get all the more difficult to make because we have seen in virtually all sectors of our lives, costs are rising, electricity and food chief among them. So the decisions will be harder to make.
Yes.
And in terms then of other family types, as you've noted, Joanna, children and the age at which those children may be, the stage of life of those children has a huge impact on the weekly spend on food. We all know you barely can keep a cupboard full if you have a teenager in the house. And it's great to see a child with a healthy appetite. But for a single parent, living on benefits, two children in preschool and primary school, the basket cost €103 per week, 29% of the household income. That proportionately seems like a higher cost, even in mathematical terms, it isn't, because you have just one person providing for two small children, one of which is about to get very expensive in terms of financing primary school.
But it's also very daunting to have to live with these decisions and to worry about this day after day, Kira. That's what we need to keep in mind. Yes, the numbers are there, but to live with this type of pressure, to worry, it's one of the basic things that we all want to do for our families. It's about nurturing. It's, you know, we have a very special relationship with food, so no one should be the food basket sets up a level, and no one should be expected to have less than that.
Well, Joanna De Silva, Chief Specialist in Nutrition at Safe Food, thank you indeed for joining us there. I'm joined now on the line by Matt McGranahan, spokesperson for the Music and Entertainment Association of Ireland. Matt, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara, as always.
You're speaking to us from Dublin City Centre, where I know you and colleagues and comrades have just finished up a rally outside Leinster House as part of the launching of your pre-budget submission. What was the idea behind holding that?
Well, the idea behind it was really we were advised by some of the politicians on the Music and Entertainment Cross-Party Committee. We compiled our budget submission a few weeks ago, presented it to them, and we submitted it to government, to the cabinet, and to all their ACTUS members last week. And it was really them who said, look, guys, you know, you should really come up to Leinster House and submit it and hold really a media launch. So we used the opportunity to come up, and it was an opportunity for musicians and ourselves to speak to a lot of the TDs and the ACTUS members as well. And we really had great support from the ACTUS members who came out in force.
Do you feel, Matt, that you're being heard?
Yeah, I've no doubt that we're being heard. Whether, I suppose, anything is going to happen or whether they're listening to it intently is the other thing. There's an awful lot of support, without a doubt, and positivity for the industry and for what we're doing for the musicians, and great understanding. But we need action on it as well. And, of course, you know, it's been a terrible 18 months for this industry and for so many in society. And we are open. We're partially open. We're looking forward to the 22nd of October for 100% reopening. But we really need investment, and we really need support from government to rebuild confidence in the public, and rebuild confidence in our workforce, and getting back to getting gigs and the industry back up and running to pre-pandemic levels.
What would assist, Matt, in the rebuilding of that confidence?
Well, we're asking for an increase in the budget, 50% increase. So there was 50 million awarded last year for the independent sector. We're asking for an increase of 75 million. And we've put forward a number of suggestions of schemes that would help fund and create employment at very much local and community levels. So we put forward a number of suggestions for schemes that would be run by local authorities to make that happen, to really identify the local musicians that need that support and getting back. We've asked for the implementation of the universal basic income for artists right across the board, which, you know, has been a recommendation in the task force report since last year. It's also the programme for government, and they have committed to that. So we're asking for that to happen in 2022. And then other factors then that we've asked for, the VAT, the reduced VAT rate to be applied to the industry at 13.5%. We feel this would help stimulate the economy within the industry as well. And we also have a request then for a pilot scheme for artists with disabilities. Currently, artists with disabilities who receive any support through social protection can only earn €140 a week. And we're hearing devastating stories that those artists are undervaluing what they do, or they're refusing work, or else they work for free. And this is absolutely, you know, it's devastating to think that. that, you know, they already have a precarious enough, as one artist said to me this morning, who turned up, they're in a double precarious situation. They're an artist which is a precarious in its nature, and then they've got this disability as well. It's just, it's a double whammy. And so we feel if they can do a pilot scheme to remove that threshold, then it would, you know, lead to more personal and professional developments and growth for that individual.
The number of artists and workers who have already had to leave the industry, almost a quarter, that's an eye-watering mm-hmm. proportion, another 40% giving it very strong consideration. Is mm-hmm. your fear, Matt, that without measures akin to those that you have suggested in tandem with a smooth and successful reopening, that there will be barely any live sector workers left in Ireland?
Yeah, that's a very real threat. We warned this about 5 or 6 weeks ago to the Minister as well, that the reopening process, the next 6 months, could have more devastating impact to this industry than the previous 18, and that's what's going to happen, and it is very scary when you see it as that, and we're seeing that in real evidence as well. We're having bands where we're talking to, and you know, one member of the band is no longer able to walk. So you know, you've got wedding bands where other musicians are coming in, and so yeah, we're losing 20% there so far. That other 40%, that's a very scary statistic. So we need to do. Government needs to do what it needs to do. Get the support. The musicians I've been speaking to today, they want to work, they want to get back to work, they don't want supports, they don't want to live on handouts. But the government need to support the industry, to build back confidence, to get music back again. We've taken it for granted for so long. I think we've been starved of live entertainment and live music for the last 18 months. And this government and society and ourselves as an industry, we need to value it and to never take it for granted again.
Well, Matt McGranahan, spokesperson for Music and Entertainment Association of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. I'm going to go now to a couple of your texts and WhatsApps. This WhatsApper to 0833 97 97 97 feels very strongly about this and says, frontline workers are people who deal with sick and dying people, e.g. doctors, nurses and carers. That's who should get the bonus payment, not teachers or anyone else. Schools shut down, hospitals did not. I know that Clem was having a conversation about this on this morning's edition of Kildare Today. And to be fair to teachers, they didn't shut down. They just weren't in the building. But I would imagine that text arose from reportage in a number of the newspapers this morning, saying that teaching unions say their members should get the COVID-19 bonus payment due to their extraordinary efforts. And most publications cited the ASTI, the INTO and the TUI, who are the primary teachers' unions. Interestingly, in about the last hour or so, the TUI insists that it has not called for a pandemic bonus payment, but it does want to be involved in discussions around acknowledging workers' contributions during the COVID cost, which is a bit different. Now, another WhatsApp to us. Jim says, Ciara, I was very disappointed about the way my message about diabetes was read out on your show yesterday. I rang Ciara yesterday to explain about the doctor you had on the show. He never spoke about metabolism. He was dreadful. You're speaking about my opening interview on the show yesterday with Professor Roy Taylor. Now, you did ring in several comments, Jim, and we're grateful for that. And the meat of those comments, I'll imagine you will recall, particularly about the impact of diabetes medication on a person and receiving its ability to lose weight, were put to Professor Taylor, and he spoke on those for about 2 or 3 minutes. Unfortunately, he didn't get to your point about metabolism because I don't think that it was part of his study, and he was here to speak about the specific study that he conducted. But thank you nonetheless both for the call. The Living Wage Technical Group has said today that the living wage in Ireland should rise by a very significant 60 cent to €12.90 per hour. I'm joined on the line now by member of the Living Wage Technical Group and also researcher at the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice, Robert Thornton. Robert, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Robert, what is the ethos behind the living wage?
Yeah, so the living wage is based on the idea that work should provide an adequate income that would enable people to have an affordable, socially acceptable minimum standard of living to take part in normal day-to-day activities, fundamentally live with dignity. So to do that, we use evidence and data to calculate the rate. So it's based on research carried out by the Ascension Partnership on the cost of what we call a minimum essential standard of living. And this research works with members of the public to build a comprehensive agreed list of all the things that are needed to enable this socially acceptable minimum standard of living. And we cost that. And from that, then, we can work out what salary and what income people would need to afford that socially acceptable minimum standard of living.
If you're on speakerphone there, Robert, I'd be very grateful if you would come off it, just because there's an echo and we want to be able to hear clearly everything that you would wish to share with us. What's interesting about the current calculation, Robert, is that the calculations would have concluded before recent rises in utility prices were evident and in food prices, although rent has ever been, I suppose, a sticking point in establishing what the living wage should be.
Yes. So the calculations are for the, based on the sort of cost as they stood at the first half of the year, really. So yeah, the most recent increases in some of the food prices and more recent spikes in energy prices aren't factored in. But nonetheless, we did already, even in that first part of the year, we're already seeing increases in home energy costs and transport costs, really based on the increases in fuel costs. But there have been slight decreases at that point in food, clothing and car insurance, for example. But all of those, when they counteracted one another to have a very small increase in living costs, but once we brought rent into the equation, that's really pushed up rent. So rent cost in the living wage calculations this year have increased by 7%. And that's the primary factor that's pushed the rate up to €12.90. In fact, if the rents hadn't increased in the last year, the rate would have increased to €12.45, so only a 15-cent increase for those other changes in living costs.
It does also mean that there is now an enormous disparity in the difference between the minimum wage, which is a state-sanctioned minimum salary that adults may earn, and the aspirational living wage of €2.70 per hour. That seems vast.
Yes, certainly. It is a big gap. There's no question about it. I suppose we produce the figure for the living wage now at this time of the year. The Low Pay Commission report on what their recommendation for the change to the minimum wage will be coming soon. So I suppose in that sense, it's a slight lag between the two points of comparison. But nevertheless, the gap is large and significant. But saying that, you know, the living wage is based on that evidence, as I said, and it shows how living costs are changing. And that's the purpose of the living wage. It provides us a benchmark of what our actual living costs are and what earnings people would need to afford to live and meet those costs.
Do we have any information, Robert, about the number of firms that have elected to pay the living wage? I know Lidl has just come out today and said that it will change the salaries of its 1,500 staff to whom this may apply up to the new living wage that has been suggested by the technical group today. But do we know across the economy how many companies may be paying it?
We don't actually know for definite. We know those companies that have said that they're paying it. So as you said, it's the voluntary rate. So in that sense, it's only those that declare that they're paying it. So we know some in the retail sector, like Lidl that you mentioned, and Aldi have previously said that they pay it as well. And there's several NGOs, for example, Oxfam and the St. Vincent de Paul, have said they make sure all their workers will be on at least the living wage. And there's other smaller employers and less public-facing employers that will pay it too, but we don't have a definitive count. But we do. By saying that, we do know that there are significant numbers. About 25% of all workers in Ireland are earning less than the living wage, and around 20% of full-time workers are below the living wage level. So there are a notable group that are below this standard.
That's a very, very significant proportion of the overall workforce when you would take the two particular cohorts together. And it means that there are tens of thousands of people across the country who are barely hanging on.
Certainly, that would be the implication. We don't know the full situation of all of those people, but it's certainly the implication. I mean, we know that there are consistently over 100,000 people in Ireland that are deemed to be
at risk of poverty while they are in work. So that's the official Central Statistics Office measurement of the at risk of poverty rate, and those people are at work, but yet that work isn't providing them enough income to rise above that very low threshold of not being at risk of poverty. There's about 123,000 people earning the minimum wage currently. So, you know, it shows us that there is an issue there around low pay, availability of hours and so on, that is putting people in a very precarious situation.
Well, Robert Thornton, member of the Living Wage Technical Group and also of the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, a new report highlights the positive health and well-being impacts of arts and creativity in later life. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Laura McQuaid. She's Evaluations and Interventions Officer at the Institute of Public Health. Laura, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, Ciara. Thank you for having me.
Delighted to do so. What do you mean by arts and creativity in later life? Because creativity could mean one thing to me and completely a different thing to you.
Certainly. We wanted to have a look at arts and creativity as a whole. We wanted to get a better understanding of the evidence around arts and creativity. So the term that we used really was just to encompass everything, anything ranging from dancing, music and singing, visual and creative arts, and drama and theatre.
And when it highlights the report highlights the positive health and well-being impacts, I would imagine you're looking at quite a broad church of positive impacts, from greater social connectedness to greater personal engagement with whatever act you're engaging in, greater physical activity, depending on the type of art that you choose to practice.
Yes, we wanted to look at what the impact was for older adults' health and well-being. So we looked at a wide range of studies internationally. We found over 70 international studies that told us the evidence about taking part in group-based art and creativity activities. And really, the strongest evidence that we found was for dancing and music and singing. In terms of dance, we found that taking part in dance can help improve our balance and mobility. It can improve our physical strength and flexibility, and it can also improve our physical activity, as well as improving our cognitive functions such as memory and learning. So these things help us as we age and can help us to continue to age positively. We also find that music and singing can help improve cognitive function and our mental well-being. And as you said, the music and singing and visual arts can help improve our quality of life, social connections, and help provide us with a sense of well-being.
And they're also mood boosters. If you're enjoying what you're doing, if you like to dance around the kitchen, if you want to dance in a more formal way, if you're singing in the shower at the top of your lungs and then take that through you as you're cleaning the house or you've joined a choir, or whatever way it is that you want to engage in any of those creative arts, because this is your choice, it is a mood booster.
Certainly, yeah. It's all about doing what you love and what you enjoy doing. And really, this provides the evidence to now tell us that this does have physical and cognitive benefits, and it can help us as we age, which is great.
And do we have any information, Laura, on how long people in later life should spend on these activities? Because we know, for example, being active, you have to be active physically a certain amount of time in the day in order to get both the physical and mental benefits. Should we be setting aside time for dancing or singing or the visual arts on a daily basis as we enter later life?
Certainly. A lot of the studies that we looked at usually were about 30 minutes to 45 minutes. Now, they were people participating in group activities and programs such as community centres, arts programs. But what we do know is that we are one of the least likely countries to actually engage in arts. We know around 25% of adults in Ireland took part in an arts activity at least once a year. This, in comparison to the EU as a whole, is around one third. And there are countries such as Austria, Denmark, Germany and Finland, and they're the most likely to perform in art activities for at least once a year. Around 50 to 70% of adults.
That's a massive difference between us then, yeah, and the Finns, Austrians and Germans. Like over half the population difference. Do you have any sense? I know it probably wasn't covered in the study, but do you have any sense, Laura, as to why that might be?
It's very hard to understand why it might be. I think what comes across from the evidence in the literature is that there are still a number of barriers to participation. So when we look at cost and affordability, as well as access to venues, the awareness and advertising of services, and sometimes the access to transport. So these could be some explanations to why possibly we're not engaging as much as what we should.
So Laura McQuaid, Evaluations and Intervention Officer at the Institute of Public Health, thank you indeed for joining us this afternoon to share with us, staying now with the tradecraft of acting. Joined on the line by Adam Trundle, he's PRO of Newbridge Musical Theatre. Adam, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much, Ciara. Great to be talking to you today.
Well, I'm delighted to have you. Now, just in case anybody is wondering, Newbridge Musical Theatre, the group formerly went by a slightly different name, but you've kind of rebranded.
Yes, we have. We decided, actually, one of the advantages of being on furlough for so long was a chance to take stock of where we are. And one of the things that came up was the name felt a little bit old-fashioned for us. You know, like, there's not that many societies going around still, you know, that haven't been set up since Victorian times. And it's also a way of kind of addressing that question of that we'd often encounter of, oh, you're in the musical society, what do you play? You know, thinking it was an orchestra or something like that.
Really?
So we think, yeah, exactly. It's gas how often that would come up. So we think that Newbridge Musical Theatre kind of leaves no room for the imagination of what it is that we do, which is putting on musical theatre productions in Newbridge every year.
And you're planning to do something very, very soon. But before we get to that, you returned to rehearsals this week for the first time since March of 2020. That must have been a strange but kind of wonderful experience.
Yes, yes. So we're returning this evening at 8 o'clock. So I have the tea bags in ready for the long catch-up chat before we get started into the singing. Yeah, we had our last rehearsal. I think it would have been the first or second week of March. It was very, very close to the announcement that we were taking 2 weeks off, which ultimately became nearly 2 years. So it's been hard to kind of keep the momentum up. You know, we've done things like virtual tea breaks over Zoom. We've had kind of catch-ups where we would all sit on Zoom and watch a musical together in our own respective homes, keeping safe. But definitely it's long overdue time to get into a room together and do a bit of singing and a bit of dancing and get all those lovely benefits that you were talking about.
Yeah.
You know, we do have members from 18 right up to well into their 80s.
Now, you won't be rehearsing together just for the sake of seeing each other, although I would imagine that that's reason enough all by itself. You've a job
Absolutely.
Of work ahead of you. You're going to hit the ground running. You're on stage in November.
We are indeed. We're in the Riverbank Theatre on the 6th and 7th of November. So that's just 6 weeks or so away now. And we're putting on a concert we're calling Music of the Night, which is going to be a celebration of some of the greatest hits from Broadway and the West End, with a particular kind of feature of Andrew Lloyd Webber's music, given that we are doing Evita, one of his most famous shows, next Easter. So expect plenty of classic hits. We're kind of, you know, pulling out all the stops for the first big return back to the stage.
Evita,
like the Phantom of the Opera and all of those great hits.
Evita is going to be a really, really big, really exciting production, I would say.
Yeah, we're really hoping so. We're really hoping that it's a nice big one with, you know, plenty of bodies on stage, so we can say to people who have maybe done shows with us and weren't sure if they wanted to come back, or people who have never done a musical before, you know, there's plenty of room to join us on stage. And as well, it's very well known with songs like Don't Cry for Me Argentina. So we're hoping that people will come along and support us and as well to come and see us with some of those songs in the next couple of weeks.
Now, Adam, with Music of the Night, I know it's kind of an Andrew Lloyd Webber songbook, but not really. But with such a wealth of songs to choose from, how do you narrow it down to fit them into two nights?
It's very difficult, and thankfully it's not my responsibility. The director of our concert and our musical director have really been scratching their heads and putting their heads together to come up with a good set list. But yeah, it is difficult to narrow it all down. But hopefully, you know, we'll have plenty of opportunities in the next few years to get everything back out again. And you know, the ones we missed this time around, we can do again shortly, hopefully.
Now, you're on stage in November. You're going to be on stage again with a big production in Easter. I would imagine that you have more shows planned for later next year. But no musical theatre group is ever static. Are you looking for new members, either front of house that are going to be on stage or sing, or those people, those magical people behind the scenes that get you on stage?
Absolutely, yeah. We're always on the lookout for new members to come and join us. And we're not alone in that. You know, there are plenty of Kildare musical theatre groups who are, you know, look out for members currently. I think Nace are having an open night actually this coming Friday, as well as Clane and Kilcock musical societies are also having some events in the next week or two. But yeah, so I suppose for anyone who is thinking that they'd love to give it a go, or they have done it and are looking to get back into it, you know, Facebook, find your nearest one. If it happens to be Newbridge, you know, we'd absolutely love to have you, and you can come and join us, whether that means you're on stage and doing the singing and dancing, or whether it means you're behind the scenes changing sets or doing the making and doing and all of the front of house. We'd love to have you in whatever capacity you would like to be involved.
And that making and doing, I mean, there's an enormous amount to do there. You've costuming, you'll have makeup, you'll have set design, set construction, you'll have lighting. You need people who are handy with, you know, a saw and a hammer and some nails.
Absolutely. I mean, like, we're very lucky, I suppose, in one sense that we're an amateur group, you know, because I know you were speaking to the Musicians Union earlier. But, you know, we do have that ripple effect of having maybe 15 to 20 people who we would hire as contractors every year doing some of those very specialised skills.
Mm.
But on top of that, obviously, we do need plenty of volunteers from our members, you know, to lend a hand with some of the more general labouring.
And just remind us when you're going to be staging the music of the night. We know it's in early November.
Yes, so it is. It is the 6th and 7th of November in the Riverbank Theatre, and we're having rehearsals tonight at 8 p.m. at KNC Performing Arts Studio behind Newbridge Silverware for anyone who fancies coming along.
Well, Adam Trundle, PRO of Newbridge Musical Theatre, thank you indeed for joining us.